Mr. K Super Show, a podcast for the discerning music and pop culture geek, hosted by Chris Karam. Welcome to Mr. K Super Show. I'm Chris Karam, aka Chris Karam, and today we are going to discuss one of my favorite bands of all time, a band that's celebrating its 45th anniversary this year. I'm talking about Van Halen, whose debut album came out 45 years ago. Yeah, if that makes you feel old, well, it should. To do that, I'm bringing back someone who's been on the show a couple of times already. He is the host of the Sly Dog Music Cast, Alex Ault. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me. I'm really pumped to talk about Van Halen. I have to say, I'm kind of surprised you picked me because I feel like I don't post about this band a lot.
One of the things I like, and I'll point this out again for our listeners who may not have heard the previous podcast, you and I are both, as we know, I'm your father. No. I'm born in 66, you're born in 93. So when you came, actually, before we start talking about the albums, the original Roth era, that's what we're going to cover. What is your Van Halen origin story?
So I was trying to figure that out, and the earliest memory I have of Van Halen is it definitely came from my dad. It seemed like when the 2004 reunion happened with Sammy, there was a bit of a Van Halen resurgence, a bit of a Van Halen, you know, like buzz again, like that big two-disc greatest hits collection came out, The Best of Both Worlds. And I remember hearing my dad play that a lot. He went and saw that tour. So I ended up hearing a lot of Van Halen around the house at the time, and I really gravitated towards a couple of the albums we're going to talk about today, especially Fair Warning and Diver Down. And just I remember being amazed by the guitar. Like, I was already, like, guitar is something I was already interested in, but then you hear Eruption for the first time, and you just sit there going, how is he doing that? Like, at one point, it doesn't even sound like guitar anymore. It's just insane. So Van Halen was just kind of ended up becoming this, like, part of something I almost heard every day. Like, my dad played it a lot in the milk barn. He played it a lot in the house. So, yeah, this is just music I grew up on, and I love it.
Yeah, they're an amazing band. You know, as for me, I mean, they came out in 1978, so I was around by that point. You know, I remember hearing, I think, Dance the Night Away. It was a single in 79 off the second album. But it wasn't until 1980 I bought the In the Cradle of Rock single, which, of course, had Could This Be Magic on the back, which is not a characteristic Van Halen song. I mean, not like it was this acoustic kind of song, just kind of them kind of goofing around. Then I got the first album. By that point, it wasn't hard to catch up on their catalog because they only had three albums at that point. So I just, you know, really dug it. And man, I'm telling you, Van Halen, you know, ended up being like the soundtrack to the 80s to me, a part of it. You know, it's hard to imagine like going through my high school years without Van Halen. And like you said, Eddie is just, Sammy Hagar once said he's not from this planet. And I kind of think he's right. You know, it bugs me when people say that Eddie Van Halen is Van Halen. He's just the only thing that matters, which is not true. Now, is Eddie the axle upon which Van Halen revolves around? Absolutely. But as we'll get into this, you know, all the other members of the group played a pivotal role in helping get that music out. And you'll realize as we delve into the trivia and stuff, it's, you know, it has a lot to do with people behind the scenes, the inner workings of the band, and you know, so with that, like I said, we're going to start off, we're going to do kind of like an album by album thing like we did with the Black Sabbath, and we're going to focus on the David Lee Roth era. I do want to do a Sammy Hagar years show at some point, and then maybe like a odds and ends show for the other stuff, you know. but anyway, going back to Van Halen, and of course, this album came out on February 10th, 1970, produced by, of course, the legendary Ted Templeman, who was not only their producer, but he was also like a vice president at Warner Brothers, their label, and an A&R guy. So he had a good track record. I mean, he'd worked with the Doobies, Little Feat, and he'd produced some big albums, Van Morrison. But, you know, Van Halen was not his typical kind of band. He was used to work with like pop acts and, you know, not so. Van Halen was like a very heavy, heavy rock band. But Alex, why don't you share your thoughts on the first Van Halen album?
I mean, where do you begin with this one? Like, this is an album that, in my mind, this record right here, this set the stage I know it came out in 78, but to me, like, the hard rock sound of the 80s does not exist without this album right here. This defined, like, a generation of guitarists. It defined a generation of frontmen. It defined fashion for a new era of hard rock, much in the same way that Nirvana would come around and do that, you know, years later. Van Halen was that band. They kicked off a whole new era. They kind of, like, I know you've been doing episodes on Led Zeppelin. That, like, Led Zeppelin to me is the sound of the 70s.
Yep.
These guys are the sound of the 80s. They started in 78. So just what an album, like just 10 straight classics. You started with Running with the Devil, this ominous kind of heavy opening that pulls you in. And then the second track's Eruption. And you really get a sense then that, you know, this is going to be like an album for a guitarist. Like, it's like, I know you said, you know, Eddie's not Van Halen, but you definitely get a sense that he's a big component here. And then
you got
Dave kind of being larger than life. One of my favorite things to listen to is, have you ever heard, it's on YouTube, the isolated vocal track of Running with the Devil?
I think I may have heard it at one point.
It's so cool because you get to hear all his little ad-libs and how animated he is as a vocalist and a frontman. It's really something, like the little things you miss sometimes. My favorite on here is On Fire, the closing track. It's just so big and ripping. And I love it because at that point in the record, you know, most times you get to the end of an album, like, okay, you've probably heard most or all of the highlights at that point. The ending might not be as big of a bang, but that song comes in and just, it's like a punch to the face. That could have been the opener of the album. It's so great. And you get there and you want to start it over again because it's like, what just happened? Mm-hmm. And I also got my favorite Van Halen cover is on this album, Ice Cream Man. I think they did a great job with that song. Love it.
Yeah, boy, they did not come out with like, oh, okay, here we are, you know, listen to our record. This was like a mission statement like no other. And I agree with what you said. You know, they came out in 78, and obviously the another album comes out in 79. But Van Halen really, to my way of thinking, is an 80s band. That's when they had their greatest impact, their greatest influence. And when you got to remember, too, Alex, when this album came out in 1978, hard rock was not in fashion. You had disco was kind of ruling the roost, yacht rock, pop, soft rock, whatever you want to call it. That was ruling the charts. So for a band to come out with an album like this, with that's just so aggressive, so over the top. And, you know, like you said, it's not just Eddie. Roth, David Lee Roth, you know, he comes in with these, a very unique and interesting vocal style. And of course, his very creative and over the top lyrics. He is just this bigger than life persona. And, you know, in a way, it's good that they had that because Eddie was not that way. Eddie was all about the music. Eddie was all about his guitar. He wasn't into being flashy or showboaty. I mean, he was like kind of glued to his instrument. And then you have like such a great combination of musicians on this record. You have obviously David Lee Roth on vocals and being the frontman extraordinaire, Eddie on guitar. Eddie's brother Alex Van Halen on drums, and I think he's a very underrated drummer. I think he really contributes a lot more to this band. He's just someone who doesn't do a lot of interviews by himself. Usually it was always in conjunction with the band. Then you have Michael Anthony, who's kind of what I call the secret sauce of this band. Laying down really solid bass lines and those soaring backing vocals. But I mean, listen to this album. You got Run with the Devil, Eruption. Their killer cover of You Really Got Me by the Kinks, which I think introduced it to a new generation, you know, certainly did me. Ain't Talking About Love, like, you know, I'm the One. Jamie's Crying, you know, there's just so many great things. And like I said, On Fire, which is, I agree with you, that could have been an opener as a, you know, you could almost like flip that with and have Running with the Devil as like the last song, which kind of ends it on a really epic way. But of course, you know, I think, you know, they made the right decision. The interesting thing about Eruption was that was not originally planned to be on the record.
Really?
Eddie was basically just warming up in the studio one day, and he was just kind of, you know, playing some of these licks. And Ted Templeman's like, we got to get that on tape. So they basically, and you can hear at one point, there's like an edit. There's two very distinct parts of the song. Like, you know, but it's not like it's, if you listen for it, you can hear it, but it's not like intrusive or anything. Yeah, this is an album that, boy, what, you know, it's my favorite Van Halen album of all time. I mean, it kind of goes neck and neck with Fair Warning. It used to go neck and neck with Fair Warning, but I've kind of realized this is the one that really sets it on the path. Here's an interesting bit of trivia, and you may not have heard about this, Alex. When Sammy Hagar joined the band in 1986, there was this rumor going around that he was originally actually being considered for the band as far back as the first album. Ted Templeman confirmed this in his autobiography a few years back. Ted Templeman was not sold on David Lee Roth. He didn't think he was a very good singer. It wasn't, you know, completely, he wasn't convinced, and he was considering getting rid of Roth and bringing in Hagar. I'm glad that didn't happen, because as would happen, Templeman basically grew to realize how great Roth really was and became actually a huge fan of his singing, his lyrics, what he brought to the band. And here's another interesting thing. Sammy Hagar and David Lee Roth both said the same thing about Eddie in different interviews, respectively, that Eddie never actually wrote songs. He wrote pieces of music, riffs, and they kind of arranged it into songs and kind of gave it structure. I could see that, because Eddie strikes me as the type who's just was very impulsive with his music and probably just was like, hey, I got this riff, or I got this little, you know, passage. But yeah, this album, Alex, man, you know, I don't care when you discover it, when you first hear it, yeah, your life has changed. This, you know, they say some things that change your life. I can honestly say that I don't know if it changed my life, but it definitely impacted it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could still remember the first time I heard this, because I'd heard a few songs from it on that best of. But yeah, then there's something about when you hear all these songs in sequence. Like, I remember putting it in my little Discman at the time, putting my headphones on and sitting down with it and just playing it and just being like, whoa. Like, just it's hard to come up with words for that experience. But you're right. Like, I think, like, life changing, or like, very, like, it creates a memory in you. It sticks with you. You don't forget it.
And when they released this record, they went on tour backing up no other than Black Sabbath. We talked about this in the Black Sabbath podcast last time. And What was interesting was that Black Sabbath was falling apart. They just weren't cutting Ozzy, you know, between the drugs and dissension, they just were not cutting it. Van Halen was coming on every night and kicking their ass. I mean, they were just showing them. I mean, they were fans, but at the same time, they weren't above saying, hey, guys, you know, come on. And they kicked their butts. Even Ozzy and Tony Iommi later admitted, you know, that they were just having their asses handed to them every night. You know, they would just come out there and really, they were young and hungry. They were pushing their first album. They were a new band to the general public. And interestingly enough, just going back a little bit, one of the people who discovered them was Gene Simmons of Kiss.
Yep.
And in fact, produced a demo tape of like 10 different songs. You can actually find it out there. It's not bad. But eventually, you know, they parted ways because he just couldn't seem to get them signed. And then, of course, shortly afterwards, you know, Ted Templeman from Warner Brothers discovers them. They do, however, thank Gene in their liner notes for that first album, if you read the thanks. But yeah, I mean, I don't have too much else to say about it other than that, you know, if you have to get one Van Halen album, this is the one to get. You should get them all, but this is the one that sets the stage.
It is without a doubt the most important record they ever made. It's the record that launched them. It launched 1,000 bands in the 80s.
Oh my God.
Without them, There's no, without them, like, even if you're not a fan of these bands, there's no Motley Crue, there's no Poison, there's no Dokken, there's no nothing like that. All those 80s hard rock bands would not have had a shot if this hadn't set the world on fire.
Even a band like the Scorpions, who'd been around for a while, ended up getting a guitar player who played, I wouldn't say like Eddie Van Halen, but in a more updated kind of 80s style that, you know, probably owes a little to Eddie. But
yeah,
you know, yeah, like you named off a lot of the bands who just realize, okay, there's a new kid in town. We got to measure up. We got to try and do as best we can to meet this standard. Although nobody plays like Eddie Van Halen.
You know? Yeah.
So we go to 1979 and March 23rd, 1979, and the release of Van Halen 2. Same producer, you know, just kind of picks up where the first one left off. Alex, what are your thoughts on the second Van Halen album?
This is one I remember as a kid. Like, I remember I knew Dance the Night Away going into it, and I was excited to hear this one. I remember being a little underwhelmed by this at first when I was a kid, because it starts with a cover of You're No Good, which I forget who did that originally. It feels more like a Linda Ronstadt song to me
Yeah.
because that's the version I think of when I think of You're No Good. So the record opens very slowly, and how do you follow that first album? That's no small task. So this is one I kind of had forgotten about over time, but after Eddie passed, I went back and checked it out again, and I was really surprised. There's some really good stuff on here I'd just forgotten about. Somebody Get Me a Doctor, just an amazing song. Dead or Alive, Beautiful Girls. Like, there's some really good stuff on here. I don't think it's quite up to the first album, but like I said, it's almost an impossible feat to follow. Measuring something else up against that anything is going to look smaller compared to that. But I do think this is a better album than I initially gave it credit for. And even listening to it, getting ready for this, I was like, I need to spin this one some more because there's some really good stuff on here, especially Somebody Get Me a Doctor. I think that's one of my favorite Van Halen songs.
Yeah, well, you gotta remember too, like they did this at the end of 1978, and they basically knocked it out like in about a week. There's that saying you have like 10 years to write your first album and like us, 10 weeks to do your second, something like that. But
Yeah.
some of these songs, of course, are songs that were written for the first album, which is typical. I mean, if you're on the road, you don't have maybe a lot of time to write new songs. I do agree, like in retrospect, leading off the record with a cover of You're No Good, which you're right, Linda Ronstadt had done a cover of that herself, and that hers is probably the most popular version. To kind of lead off with that is kind of odd, although I kind of really hard, find it hard to imagine the album in any kind of a different track sequence these days. Dance the Night Away was a that was an AM that was like a top 40 rock single. I mean, that was just you actually heard that on Casey Kasem back in 1979. If you're old enough to remember Casey Kasem, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, is it as good as the first album? No, but I think it's a damn good album. Like you said, Somebody Get Me a Doctor, Out of Love Again. In fact, there's this kid, I think his name is Avery something. He was like 5 years old at the time. He did a drum cover of Out of Love Again. I think it was Out of Love Again. Yeah. And he nailed it. I mean, there's some really complex drumming on this album, and I think that's one of those songs that falls in that category. But he did it
Oh,
great.
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, DOA, there's a funny story about that song in Beautiful Girls. You probably didn't see this. Back in the 90s, Adam Sandler and Chris Farley were both on Saturday Night Live, and they did a commercial parody of for a product called Schmidt's Gay Beer.
I
And
remember
it's
this.
basically them hanging around a pool with a bunch of these like muscle clad guys. And anyway, when all of a sudden when the guys start surfacing out of nowhere, you hear the opening to DOA by Van Halen. And then they just go into Beautiful Girls as like the music for the commercial. And it's just hilarious. I mean, what's sad though is probably because of like music licensing issues, anytime I've seen it in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, it doesn't have the Van Halen music anymore. It just has this generic kind of heavy guitar, which kind of like the whole thing about it is you're hearing beautiful girls and a bunch of guys are strutting around. But
Right.
anyway, DOA, great song. A friend of mine who was in a band, not a Van Halen tribute, but like just a band, used to cover that, and I always enjoyed that. Beautiful Girls. It's such a the imagery of that song. You can actually picture it in your head, like somebody. You can picture David Lee Roth on the beach, just kind of hanging out and checking out girls. And there's some, Women in Love is kind of an obscure track, but again, this was a band that, was in that tour cycle. They, think about it, they just got off the road with Black Sabbath. I mean, they probably should have gone to Betty Ford, or
Right.
they would lay it. Well, actually, Betty Ford didn't exist, but they probably needed like to detox for a week. Because those guys were partying pretty hard back then, but that's what bands did back in those days, for better
Yeah,
or for worse.
the Van Halen party stories are notorious,
Well,
whether it be the brown M&Ms or
you know
the
what the Brown M&Ms was really about?
just making sure they got the writer correct, I think.
Yeah, they put that in next to some stuff about safety, like staging, and they realized if they didn't know about the Brown M&Ms, they really hadn't read the con, which I'm sure, most of the promoters just said, yeah, whatever, and signed off on it. But that
Yeah.
was the whole thing. Yeah, if there were Brown M&Ms in the bowl, they had license to trash the place without recriminations or anything, but yeah. But getting back to this record, this is a very solid album. I mean, is it the first album? No, but it's there's some darn good stuff on here. I mean, Eddie is of course playing his ass off, and you know, Roth is just kind of Dave is being Dave. I mean, what can you say? You know?
Oh yeah. Yep. Larger than life. Wonderful. Appreciates over time. Appreciates with repeated listens.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, I think the first album cover is better. It's a little more dynamic. Oh, yeah. You know, you get those great pictures in that logo. This one just has the logo basically, but you know, when you're Van Halen, you know, that's the great thing about having that is that you can kind of fall back on that as an album cover, which they will, you know, more often than not. But anyway, any more thoughts on Van Halen 2, Alex, or?
I will just say that, like I said, appreciates in value, and the back cover is one of my favorite Van Halen photos. I love the splits, and then each band member, you know, Eddie with that classic black and yellow guitar, Michael doing his classic pose. And then the drums looking like they're just exploding if you look closely at them.
I think if you had the original album, there's a picture sleeve on the inside, and there's a picture of David Lee Roth with like a cast on his foot. Apparently, he was doing one of his high jumps and injured his foot. So they, you know, decided to kind of make lemons out of lemonade or lemonade out of lemons. And there's a picture of him with his foot in a cast, and of course, they have a couple of sexy nurses, you know, administering to him. So, you know, like you said, the partying was pretty crazy in those days. And, you know, those guys didn't hold back. I mean, nothing was going to stop Van Halen from doing what they did. But I mean, it didn't hurt them back then, at least, you know, not then.
Nope.
So we jump ahead to 1980 and March 26, 1980, and the release of Women and Children First. Once again, like the first two albums produced by Ted Templeman. Alex, your thoughts on Women and Children First?
This is, everything we're going to talk about today was the one I was the least familiar with. It was probably the one I played the least as a kid, and even kind of like before, like after Eddie passed, and I kind of did a deep dive again. There's some good stuff on here I forgot about. Everybody does on the Cradle Will Rock. Everybody Wants Some. That's a top Van Halen song for me. I love that. I love the build and Dave just kind of doing his like. Throwing in a little spoken word every so often in that song. It oozes the Van Halen personality. It's one of those band defining songs. It's who they are. There's some really interesting stuff on here I forgot about, like Tora Tora into Loss of Control, that kind of like weird Black Sabbath-esque guitar intro into this really like just heavy punch you in the face song. Again, with shout out to Alex Van Halen. He just going crazy on that song on the drums, just insane. So, yeah, this is one I don't know as well, but I spent a little time with it, and I did go, okay, there's some stuff here I'm kind of missing out on. I like Take Your Whiskey Home and Could This Be Magic? So, yeah, good stuff on here.
What's interesting about this record is this is the first Van Halen album where there's no cover tunes. It's all them. And they're going darker on this album. They're going, you know, there's definitely a feeling of, you know, a bit more of an edge. I mean, less of the party hardy kind of thing, and more there's definitely like aggression in these songs. I mean, you listen to a song like Fools, and you know, you can kind of tell like it's Roth kind of just going off on people who probably put him down for having long hair and being a rock and roll guy. You know, I Live with Fools, and he sings it with so much attack. Obviously, in the Cradle of Rock, you know, have you seen Junior's
grades?
What's interesting about that song is that the main, what you're hearing in that song is actually not a guitar.
Yeah.
That main riff is actually Eddie playing electric piano through a guitar amplifier. So it's got that kind of distortion on it, but it's not really a guitar. I mean, obviously he soloed, the solo on it is guitar, which you can't deny, but yeah, they were experimenting back then. I think even back then live, they had some keyboards. I think Michael Anthony was like playing keyboards on some of the songs. And, they're expanding the sound. I mean, and that's what bands do, is they kind of grow into what they're doing. You know, you've got like Romeo Delight, which is a really, really killer track. That was actually a set opener on the Diver Down tour, or as it's known, the Hide Your Sheep tour. Make of that what you will. But yeah, this album, I mean, you've got You've got a track like Could This Be Magic, which, by the way, has an uncredited backing vocal by Nicolette Larson. Nicolette Larson did a song called Lot of Love back in 78, 79, which was produced by Ted Templeman. And in fact, if you listen to that record, I forget the name of the song, but there's a song where Eddie clearly plays guitar on it. And, you know, it was one of those things where he just produced the first album. So Templeman had no, you know, compunctions about saying, hey, Ed, you want to play in this song? So they got her to sort of sing backing vocals uncredited because, you know, back then they very seldom, if ever, used like outside musicians. And if they did, it was kind of like they didn't want people, they wanted to kind of maintain the illusion, like, or whatever, the image that it was Van Halen. You've got, you know, Take Your Whiskey Home, which is a nice heavy rocker. You know, Loss of Control, which is just them kind of like just speeding up. I mean, like, just kind of like, you know, it's, I wouldn't say it's thrash metal, but it's definitely got a fast pace to it. And, you know, these guys were just kind of going in there, and they're at a point now where they're not holding back. They're doing all these crazy little, you know, interludes like Tora Tora, which is just basically like some sound effects and some, you know, maybe like 30 seconds of, you know, them playing kind of this bluesy thing with these weird, you know, weird backing vocals. But I mean, you know, in the Cradle, everybody wants some. That came, interestingly, Roth kind of said that somewhere. And Ted Templeman, like, heard that, the producer, and said, write that down in your notebook. Save that for later. And when it came time, they, you know, Roth came up with that whole everybody. And then, of course, there's that little thing at the back, you know, I really like it when it runs up the back of the stocking. And
yeah.
You know, and it's just like, and what's interesting, if you listen very closely, at the very end of the song as it's fading out, he goes, I'm paying for this. What the fuck? But it's, like, it's very like low in the mix. It's very like they're fading it out. So you have to listen for it. Obviously, they probably wanted to avoid getting, well, they didn't have actually have labeling at that point. But this is around the time when these Nervous Nellies were starting to look for anything they could find on hard rock bands, you know. Trying to subvert the youth of the 1980s, Alex. It was a interesting time. But yeah, I mean, you have any other thoughts on Women and Children First?
I will say this is kind of, I remember reading a book about Van Halen as a kid. It seemed like things, commercially at least, single-wise, this is where things start to take a mild temporary downturn. From, you know, the first two albums were definitely hits. The second one had Dance the Night Away. First one was just career defining. This one had In the Cradle Will Rock, but it definitely sold less than the first two. And then the next one, unfortunately, which we'll talk about in a second, is the lowest selling Van Halen album, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, no band, you know, can sustain a certain level of success. And obviously every band has their ups and downs. I think artistically they were on a high on this album. I mean, they're just, like I said, they're going dark. And that's, I think when bands go dark, you know, it definitely enhances their music. I mean, Van Halen, you know, they were a bunch of aggressive young guys. We jump ahead to 1981 and a very, very significant album. Of course, I'm talking about Fair Warning, which was released on April 29th, 1981. And if you thought Van Halen went dark on Women and Children First, you ain't seen nothing yet. Alex?
Oh man, I've been waiting to talk about this one. I like that you mentioned that right up top, that, you know, Van Halen going dark. This is Van Halen at their darkest, dirtiest, sleaziest, maybe their heaviest album. Yeah. And before I get to the music, I'm going to start with the artwork itself, and that in itself being dark. You look at this cover, you see a guy getting punched in the face. He's bloody, and there's two people watching. There's a guy beating his head against the wall. There's like a giant that looks like he's stepping on a person. And if you flip it over, you've got like this conveyor belt with like a person strapped on it about to be squished. And you can see where there's another person that's been squished, and just these unsettling images everywhere. Yeah. Like that was one of the things I remember about this as a kid. I used to just stare at the artwork for this thing because like, what is this? And then you put it on. And out of the speakers comes Mean Street, like with Eddie doing some of his like insane, crazy tapping, probably some of the best he's done since Eruption. And then you immediately move into Mean Street, and that sets the whole tone. And look at these song titles: Mean Street, Dirty Movie, Sinner Swing, Unchained, So This Is Love. Yeah, something is going on here. It's hard to put your finger on it, like why it's so dark, but it's really interesting. I love this whole album. This, after the first one, is probably my favorite. And some days this feels like my favorite Van Halen album. Dirty Movies is really cool. I love Dave on that one again, doing some of his fun ad-libbing. You know, man, remember when that girl used to be prom queen?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And, yep, Unchained, great single. And I love the breakdown in the middle. One Break coming up. And then one of my favorite Van Halen songs of all time, Sinner Swing. Just so aggressive. And it is a swing tune. It has that feel to it. And I remember being shocked as a kid because, to me, I grew up listening to a lot of classic rock, and in classic rock, it didn't seem like there was that much foul language. Like, you get a little raw language sometimes, but most of that stuff was reserved to the modern music, in my mind, at least. And then I hear Dave say, "She looks so fucking good, so sexy, and so bold." Yeah. I'm like, whoa, you got this on an album in 1981? Like, how did you do that?
It's insane. That was the thing. When I'd be listening to that, I would hope that my mom wouldn't walk by or hear it. I mean, not that she would have made a big deal out of it. She probably did hear it, just kind of rolled her eyes and kept going. But yeah, that was a big deal, because in the early 80s, you really didn't have, like you said, a lot of cursing on rock albums. Yeah, you know, there'd be the occasional little innuendo or maybe.
Yeah.
But very seldom did you hear cursing. So, Alex, I agree with you. This, you know, depending on the day of the week, this could be my favorite Van Halen album. It's definitely my second favorite. It's very dark. It's very edgy. You know, you start off with like Mean Street, and Eddie, like in guitar interviews, would say that he was doing what the funk bass players were doing. As he was slapping and tapping the string, he's going, and like, you're listening to this and you're like, what is this? This guy really is from another planet. And then like the band kicks in. Like I said, it's sleazy. It's dirty. I mean, Mean Street is like, it's got this like funk to it, but it's like hard edged, nasty funk. And, you know, somebody said, "Fair warning." Well, Lord strike that poor boy down. And he just goes, "Phew." Like, it's so on the nose. I mean, this is very like, you know, Dirty Movies. I mean, you think back to like high school and that girl who was, you know, the prom queen, and you know, who knows what happened to her. But, you know, very, you know, Sinner Swing, which, you know, very like fast. And then it goes into that double time boogie thing, like in the middle of the song. And dun, 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 you know, it's like boogie on speed, you know. And I'm sure those guys were, you know, indulging themselves a bit in the, you know, devil's dandruff by that point, which is no, you know, not exactly a shock to anybody's Van Halen. What was interesting about this record, and Ted Templeman, you know, it was said for a long time that like they were going in, him and the engineer Don Landy, Eddie and the engineer Don Landy were going to the studio late at night when nobody was around and working on parts. And Ted Templeman said, "I knew what they were doing because I would hear the tapes the next day. I was fine with them doing it," because he said he felt that sometimes when the producer's around, you know, the artist will tense up a little bit. So this was definitely Eddie taking more control of the process and his influence. And, you know, this record, I don't know if you're aware of this, Alex, at the time it came out, it was not a big seller, it didn't sell as well as the previous three. And in fact, their manager at the time, Noel Monk, had to resort to some underhanded tactics to get some airplay. I think it was for Unchained or This Is Love, which one of the singles, and they actually, you know, engaged in some payola, some bribery to radio guys, you know, which, believe it or not, was not an uncommon thing back then. The biggest of the best were doing it. You know, you basically would give the guys cocaine or hookers or money in order to get preferential playing for your record. Now, you can't buy a hit, obviously, but if you have in certain markets, it ensured that the album did okay. It went platinum, I think, over, but it didn't go platinum as quickly as the previous ones. But yeah, Alex, this is a killer album. I mean, even stuff like Sunday Afternoon in the Park, which is basically Eddie just kind of fooling around on a synthesizer. Great stuff. You know, Hear About It Later, killer track. Push Comes to Shove, which is kind of them doing almost a weird kind of reggae-ish kind of thing. So This Is Love. They even shot some videos for this live performance clips on that tour, and you can find them on YouTube very easily. I wish they had just filmed the whole show and released it, but
Right.
Van Halen, as we know, as we've talked about, they're very stingy when it comes to stuff that's in the vault. So who knows what they've got in there, tucked away
Yeah.
in the vaults. But yeah,
Yeah.
this was a great time to be a Van Halen out. this is a great time to be a Van Halen fan because they were just firing on all cylinders. And this, but like I said, this album did not do as well commercially, and it's going to kind of come back to haunt them in a way with the next record. But you have any other thoughts on Fair Warning, Alex?
I'll just say I agree with everything you said. Yeah, this is a magic moment in Van Halen history, and like not to be missed. Like it's just because it's the lowest seller in their catalog, that's no indication of the quality here. It's quite a special album to me. I play it a lot. It's probably like one of the ones I go to the most. Yeah, love it. Classic. Amazing.
They did a big tour to support this, and it did very well. And the album, like I said, eventually went platinum. But they were kind of burned out at this point. They wanted Eddie in particular wanted to have more time to write and to develop material. He wanted the band's sound to mature, as you hear on this record. I mean, they basically decided they were going to take 1982 off, and David Lee Roth came up with an idea. Back then, you bands were putting out a record like every year. So David Lee Roth felt, let's do a single, a one-off single, a standalone single, which we'll put out. It'll keep our name out there while we work on the next album. So originally, they proposed to do a cover version of "Dancing in the Streets" by Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, the old Motown song. Eddie's not too crazy about that idea, so he proposes doing "Oh Pretty Woman" by Roy Orbison. So they put out the single, and they back it with an a cappella version of the Roy Rogers and Dale Evans cowboy music movie song "Happy Trails," and they release it. Well, be careful what you wish for. It not only kept their name out there, but it was actually a hit, and it was doing, and I think it made like the top 10 or the top 20. Well, Warner Brothers all of a sudden is like, guys, you got a single out. We need an album. They were not really ready to do an album. But nevertheless, when the powers that be demand an album, they get what they want. So the band kind of hastily went back to the studio with Ted Templeman and did an album that would be comprised of a lot of cover tunes, some new songs, and of course I'm talking about Diver Down, which was released in 1982 on April 19th. And when this album came out, it already had a hit single, so it did very well. In fact, it did better commercially than Fair Warning did. This album is kind of a divisive album with Van Halen fans. But before I get into why, Alex, you can lead off with your thoughts on Diver Down.
Yeah, I love that you brought up that this was kind of demanded by the label, because that's something I was going to share too. Yeah, this is a strange album in their catalog. I have a big soft spot for it because when I was a kid, I didn't know a lot of these songs were covers. I knew "Dancing in the Street" was because I used to hear that on the radio at my grandma's house, but "Where Have All the Good Times Gone," "Pretty Woman," "Big Bad Bill," I had no idea those songs were covers. I just thought they were great, great songs. So I really do enjoy listening to this one. I understand why someone might not rate it as high, but listening to this one just puts a smile on my face. It reminds me of growing up and discovering rock and roll and discovering Van Halen. So I do like, despite an overabundance of interludes, I think on this album, there's some interesting stuff here. I think "Little Guitars" is a great song. I think "The Full Bug" is a great song. Love that Kinks cover, "Where Have All the Good Times Gone." I'm even partial to the Big Bad Bill of Sweet William Now thing. I think Dave sounds so comfortable on that song. Like, he really is able to kind of like it's his Van Halen voice, but it kind of fits that jazzy vibe. He really slots into it nicely, and you've got Eddie Van Halen and Alex Van Halen's dad, Jan Van Halen, playing clarinet on there. So I think it's an interesting album. It's a strange album. but for me, I have a soft spot for it. I understand why it might have some contention with Van Halen fans, but for me, it's a fun listen every now and then.
Yeah, it's my least favorite of the original era, but like you said, I do have a soft spot for it. There are some good songs on here, the cover tunes, you know, you're getting kind of a, you know, this, they weren't ready. They weren't ready to do a record. They didn't have anything written, or I think like Hang 'Em High, which is one of their originals on here, I think that was a song that dates back to their earliest demos. But, you know, you have Cathedral, which is this little guitar interlude where he's just doing volume swells and, you know, but again, Where Have All the Good Times Gone? One of your more obscure King songs, which they probably popularized. Yeah, and this album did very well for the band. I mean, they were coming off a hit single, which, like you said, you know, just speak like something like Fair Warning, which is a darker album and maybe not as commercial, doesn't mean it's, you know, I think that album is far better than this one. But this one is, you know, it's got its merits. You know, Eddie, on the other hand, did not like this record. And in fact, decided after this record came out that he was going to build his own studio. He wanted to have more control over the music. But this album gave them a huge hit. They did another tour, the, like I told you, the aforementioned Hide Your Sheep tour, which culminated in a appearance at the US Festival in 1983, where they were the highest paid band the whole weekend. It was this big 3-day music festival. Like, there was, I think it was like New Wave Day, Heavy Metal Day, which Van Halen was the headliner, and then you had like I don't know, just like
Rock Day.
Yeah. And it was one of these things that was interesting because, you know, it sold a lot of tickets and a lot of people went, but I guess it lost money. They only had two of these. They had one in 82. This, you know, this one took place in 83. But if you watch, if you've ever seen Van Halen's performance from the US Festival, they're wasted. I mean,
oh yeah,
they're just total. But you know, I think Roth shows it the worst when he's just forgetting. He goes, "I forgot the fucking words," you know. But yeah. But I mean, everybody's playing great. I mean, it's really not like. But yeah, they're clearly, you know, fried. I mean, they're clearly not. You know, but Van Halen wasn't exactly known for being choir boys back in those days. I mean, those guys were partying pretty heavy at this point, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, they weren't even on tour at the time of the US Festival. Like, Roth was on some kind of, like, African safari.
Oh, he did a lot of those. He was frequently doing stuff like that, safaris and jungle trips and climbing mountains. I mean, if you look at the album Skyscraper, his solo album, that's not...
Yeah.
A Photoshop, that's actually him climbing a mountain, you know. Roth was like,
I didn't know that. That's crazy.
Well, Roth is just one of those guys. Wow. Who's very, very athletic and very, you know, likes to keep busy, very smart guy. Actually, I think his image as a sort of, you know, clown in a way belies the fact that he's actually a very intelligent guy. I think he just likes people to think that he's this goofy rock god kind of guy.
I was gonna say, yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Diver Down, not their best album, probably my least favorite, but not without its merits. And I can, you know, I can see why people enjoy it. It's kind of a fun record. Maybe Fair Warning was a little too dark for some people, you know, a little too edgy. I didn't bother me, of course. I think it's one of their best albums, but you know, again, a hit album. The guys were just unstoppable at this point. I mean, here's a record that by, you know, depending on how you look at it, is not as good as some of the previous ones, but still sells. You know, they did end up doing, of course, Dancing in the Street, which they utilized. They began with an Eddie keyboard riff.
Yep.
That, you know, he was trying to find a home for, and then they just grafted it onto their cover version, which was also a single and actually did pretty well. I don't have too much else to say about Diver Down. You, Alex?
Yeah, I'll just say I agree with you. It's probably the least of the original ones, but still, this is a damn solid album if it's like the least of the original David Lee Roth run. And end of an era, I think. I think this is the end of like the kind of the first era of Van Halen. I know the next album still has Dave on it, but I feel like the next era of Van Halen starts with 1984.
Well, yes, and what happened was that, like I said, Eddie Van Halen, he was kind of having a sort of like love-hate, tug push and pull, tug and pull kind of thing with their producer, Ted Templeman. Like most artists, Eddie wants to do what Eddie wants to do, and he doesn't want to be told how and when he can do it. So he began building in 1982, 83, began building a studio, which he would call 5150, which is named after the California police code for someone who's criminally insane or escaped mental patient. Interesting choice, but and what's interesting is that Ted Templeman thought he was recording like a demo studio, like just a studio where he could record, you know, lay down tracks. And no, this was a full-on recording studio where Eddie wanted the band to record their music. In fact, where they would go from that point on. And you're right. You know, a lot of people like to blame Sammy Hagar for the band becoming a pop band with keyboards and, you know, ballads and whatever. But it really begins on the 1984 album, which they spent 1983 kind of recording off and on. But they really took their time. And in fact, there was a bit of drama regarding the master tape. The engineer, Don Landy, for some reason, like, was holding on to them and wasn't letting anybody near them. And they were supposed to deliver like the tapes to Warner Brothers by, like, I don't know, November 1st of 83. And they didn't do it. And Ted Templeman, like, couldn't even get to Don Landy. And he was like thinking, well, we might have to use safety copies and remix the album from those. And a safety copy is basically a second tape deck that you're running while your main recording console is just in case like something happened to the tapes. But generally speaking, you don't want to use safety copies because they're generally not as good quality. They're like kind of like a step down. Well, long story short, they got the tapes finally and sanity was restored. And this was the first, 1983 was the first year that, you know, like Van Halen did not have a record out, but they did come out on January 9th, 1984 with 1984. And this was the album that propelled Van Halen from being a hit band to being a superstar band. I mean, they had a number one single, and things are going to be a lot different from here on out. Alex, what are your thoughts on 1984?
This is an album I am very familiar with. I'd say two of the albums my dad played the most when I was growing up are Rats Out of the Cellar and Van Halen's 1984. So I know this album back to front very well, and I love it. I think it's a great record. Like we said, the keyboards start to make their appearance. The first sound you hear on this album is keyboard. It's an instrumental interlude called 1984, and then you put right into Jump. So I'm sure people at the time immediately like, this is new Van Halen. But yeah, to me it's an interesting, you know, start to the album. I think there's still some great rockers here. Panama, obviously, that was a big hit. Top Jimmy is a fun song. House of Pain, which is an older one. But I want to talk about two of my favorites real quick. Hot for Teacher. I think that's one of the best band performances of Van Halen. The drums, the guitar, the bass, everything, Dave's voice, like it just oozes personality. And it, to me, if I were to like play an Alien, a Van Halen song to show them what they're about, that's one of the ones I would play them. I would probably play them stuff from the first album, and I'd play them Hot for Teacher because that to me sums up what Van Halen is. It's just so energetic and forceful and in your face. And the other song I love, and again, it's a kind of a harbinger of the new era, is All Wait. I love Dave's voice on that song. I love the keys. I think that's the best keyboard song on the album. They're kind of eerier and they fit the mood of the song. And there's even a synth bass on the song. It's not a bass guitar, it's a synth bass. So a bit different. It's the end of David Lee Roth's first run in the band. They did a big tour for this one. They had Autograph opening. But this was, yeah, like you said, this made them, I think, kind of like solidified them as the like an 80s band completely. Like their staying power was here. If they never made another record after this, they'd still be as big as like they are now.
Well, you know, you got to remember, like, Jump went to number one on the U.S. singles charts, which Van Halen had never done before and would never do since. Interestingly enough, though, when Eddie Van Halen demoed Jump, both David Lee Roth and the producer, Ted Templeman, did not like it. They did not. David Lee Roth said something like, nobody wants to see your dead ass playing keyboards. But Eddie was relentless. I mean, I think he might have demoed that around 82, but they kind of poo-pooed it. Well, this time he said, I don't care, I'm doing it. And it's full-on keyboard synthesizer, you know, with the 1984 intro kind of leading into it. Alex, MTV back in those days this MTV actually played music videos back then. They were actually really, they played that video so much that if I heard the song on the radio, I could literally visualize the video frame by frame in my head. I'm not joking.
Yeah.
It was on like almost every hour. It was just, and you know, the funny thing about it was that it's a very simple video. It's just a simple performance clip, which they did themselves. Like they said, the biggest thing in the budget was the beer, you know, and someone called them and said, "Hey, who was the director of that video? They wanted to hire them." And they go, "We did it." So it was kind of like, huh? And of course they did videos for Panama. One of the interesting things about the song "I'll Wait" is that if you bought the original album when it first came out, it was missing a credit. Michael McDonald from the Doobie Brothers, who was also produced by Ted Templeman, was brought in to co-write "I'll Wait" with David Lee Roth, basically to work with Roth on kind of the lyrics and the vocal melody. And, you know, they did it and it came out pretty good, as you know. It was a single, the second single. But what happened was that when the album originally came out, it did not credit Michael McDonald as a co-writer and didn't give his, you know, that caused some strife, especially for Ted Templeman, because Ted Templeman was the one who kind of, you know, asked Michael McDonald, "Hey, would you consider working with, you know, Van Halen or working with David Lee Roth?" If you buy it now, I'm pretty sure they rectified that. The credits are there, but it kind of caused a little bit of a rift between Ted Templeman and Michael McDonald. But anyway, yeah, this album, like I said, this propelled Van Halen to the stratosphere. They were no longer like a hit band. They were a superstar band. They were on the cover of magazines. You know, they were doing a tour that was one of the biggest tours of the year. Ironically, of course, behind the scenes, things were not very well. And in fact, basically by the end of the tour, nobody was talking to each other. They were able to pull it together on stage, but, you know, it was getting, from what I heard, like a little self-indulgent, like Eddie's solo went on forever. And, you know, they all had these solo spots that took up like a lot of time in the show. But on the surface, if you were a fan in 1984, you didn't know about any of that stuff. This wasn't like now where if somebody stubs their toe, you hear about it. They were on top of the world, literally. They were, this album was a huge seller. I don't know what the sales figures are, but I have to imagine it's probably at least 5 or 6 million sold already.
Oh, it's a diamond album.
It's a diamond album. Okay, yeah, well, that makes sense. You know, this, like I said, they had a number one single. It's weird that the album itself didn't go to number one. But then again, Thriller was kind of still hovering on the charts at that point, Michael Jackson's Thriller. So, yeah, record, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff on here. The band, clearly Eddie, you know, after Diver Down, he wanted the band to kind of be generating their own material. Girl Gone Bad, there's some really great guitar parts on that. Hot for Teacher, the video is just completely over the top. And, you know, you look back and it's like, man, the stuff they would let on the air back in the 1980s, you know. There was actually a contest that went along with this called the Lost Weekend with Van Halen, MTV sponsored contest. And the winner got to go on tour with Van Halen. And apparently, like, it was no holds barred. I mean, you know, they partied. Yeah, it was a young kid too. I mean, he was probably like 18 or I think he was over 18. I think, you know, but he and his friend or whatever, they went on tour and they, you know, you'd never see that now. Nobody would ever do it because it'd be a liability putting a young person in harm's way. I mean, those guys, you know, weren't shy about powdering their noses, so to speak. obviously they're drinking quite a bit of drinking, you know, Michael Anthony, you know, taking hits off a Jack Daniels bottle and rolling around the stage with his Jack Daniels bass. But these guys were on top of the world. And you would think that after this tour, you know, that would just be the springboard for more activity. But as we both know, the band pretty much imploded after this tour. 1985 comes. David Lee Roth releases this EP called Crazy from the Heat, and he does covers of California Girls and Just a Gigolo, and the videos are huge. Same, basically, him and Pete Angelus, who was one of their guys, they directed it like they did the videos for 1984. Huge hit, and Roth is offered an opportunity to do a movie version of it, like the video, just sort of he decides to take it and say, well, you know what? I'm going to do this movie. And if you guys want, you can do the soundtrack album. And then maybe I'll come back in a year. And they basically said, screw you. So Roth officially leaves the band, and Van Halen's future is in, you know, in doubt. We all know what happened, but, and we'll probably get into that in a future episode, but it was definitely the end of an era. And interestingly enough, we would never see the original Van Halen like get back together. Well, they would briefly in 1996, but you know, this was really the end of the original era. We didn't, like I said, we didn't know it in 1984, but when 1985 came around, it was like a punch in the gut. Like, what? You know, I mean, I don't know. What are your thoughts on the splintering of Van Halen in 1985, Alex?
It probably was inevitable in some ways, especially given like the way like the effect the tour had on the band, then Dave's ambitions, and the band probably kind of being like, you know, what are you doing? Like, I'm sure that there was some push and pull there, and just different directions. Eddie wanting to go in a more keyboard based direction. I'm not sure Dave wanted to go that same route either. So I think it was an inevitable split, unfortunately, but the fact that it was the end of an era that we never kind of really saw, like, I don't even know that, like, I don't think they ever played, like, that lineup ever played live after the 1994. No. I know they did those songs for that best of, but that's it. Like, that's like a, they stopped at the top, that lineup of the band.
Yeah, if you look at it that way, sure, yeah. Yeah, their biggest album, they're, you know, really kind of got them across to a mass audience. I mean, you know, everybody knew Van Halen in 1984. And, you know, you look at, we all know that Eddie and Dave were never really exactly best buddies, but they had chemistry. You can say what you want about Roth. He's got lead singer disease. He's over the top. He's this, he's that. But, you know, you give him like Eddie's music, it's like they matched. Even Ted Templeman, like I told you on the first album, when he wasn't, you know, originally that sold on him, he eventually kind of realized, wow, this guy's really good and really knows his stuff. And, you know, he put a very unique lyrical spin on the Van Halen music. He gave them like an outsized kind of persona. You know, even if you were just looking at pictures of Van Halen, Roth just, you know, like jumped out at you, literally. No pun intended, you know. And they had those very flamboyant outfits and costumes, and, you know, they were like America's party band. But, you know, at the same time, you had this guitar player who was mind boggling, who everybody, a lot of people wanted to sound like. By that time, 1984, you had a lot of these metal bands or these hair metal bands or whatever trying to sound like Eddie or trying to emulate that Van Halen style. Sometimes pulling it off, sometimes not. But Van Halen just had that unique combination of elements in terms of the music and players and just the attitude. You know, it's, but you never would have thought back in 1984, I certainly didn't, that this would be it. Like, you think, okay, then there'll be another album out in a couple of years and they'll just keep going. Well, they did, but obviously with a very different singer and a bit of a different sound, although not a radically different sound. Some people may disagree with that. And at some point, I would like to do a Sammy Hagar Van Halen show, because there's some really good material to be heard. I just feel like when you're doing a show like this, I feel like you want to kind of keep the eras separate.
Yeah.
I mean, just sort of, because, you know, like I said, this is the end of an era. And they never really reconvened. I mean, the closest they came was when they did that appearance on the MTV Video Music Awards in 96, which, you know, ironically ended up being kind of a disaster, and we'll probably talk about that in a later episode. But yeah. Van Halen, one of the greatest bands of all time. You know, it's 45 years since that first album. And, you know, I can only speak for myself here, but like, it's been what, 2.5, almost 3 years since Eddie passed. And I'm still like, I don't know, man, I'm still kind of trying to come to terms with it that he's gone, because he's such a, Van Halen's music and his playing was such a big part of my growing up.
Yeah, it's such a strange like loss, in a way. He's a pillar of rock and roll. He's so important to the guitar sound. He's like a giant, and the fact that he's not here anymore, the fact that Van Halen kind of ends after that really strange tour in I think 2015, like that's it. It's such a strange thing that he's gone now. So yeah, I feel you there. The
Yeah.
one thing it has done is I really do feel like I find myself visiting the catalog more and
Yeah.
really appreciating, like, wow, like that legacy that he created. It's
Well,
amazing.
apparently before he died, and Eddie confirmed this actually in an interview, in late 2010s or whatever, that they were trying to get a what they call the kitchen sink Van Halen tour. They were going to get everybody, even Gary Cherone supposedly, and just have
Yep.
everybody together, Michael Anthony, Wolfgang, and they were just going to play, I guess, Sam and Dave would come up at different points, sing their song. Maybe they'd even do a song together, though I doubt it. Gary Cherone might even come up and do a song, or at least take their drink orders. sorry, I don't mean that. Well, I do. But yeah, I mean, but of course Eddie was also very sick at the time and he was dying, but we didn't, there were rumors going around about his health. But when you hear rumors, you kind of just sort of dismiss those rumors and think, well, you know what? Maybe he'll be okay. Maybe he'll come out of this. But obviously, as we found out in October of 2020, in fact, one of the earliest shows I did with my original podcasting partner, Mark, just as we were getting the show launched, like Eddie passed. So I think our fourth episode is just us talking about Eddie for, like an hour or so, whatever. And we both, and I'm gonna, it's, I guess I can pitch this question to you, but you do have an awareness of 80s music. What would the 80s have been like, Alex, if Eddie Van Halen had never surfaced or come on the scene?
I don't know that rock and roll in the same way would have had the same presence it did, because it kind of be to, like I said, Van Halen kind of begets that hard rock renaissance in the 80s, I think. And I
Yeah.
think without that Van Halen album, rock would still have existed and been there, but I think new wave would have had a longer shelf life. I
Yeah.
think there you wouldn't have seen as many like hard rock bands like a Rat or Motley Crue pop
Right.
up. It would have been a very different trajectory. I don't think metal kind of bubbles up in the way it does, like a Metallica even. I don't think that kind of like takes off in the same way. I think it all kind of like gets a little more pop, goes a little more of a pop direction, and maybe a little more of even like a punk direction, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely more of a hard rock resurgence in the early 80s, like you said, with Rat and Motley Crue. And those bands probably wouldn't have been propelled into the limelight if not for Van Halen. And they're just one of the greatest bands of all time. We can always go back and listen, whether you like Roth, Hayes, and it's okay to like both, folks. It's okay. Alex, what are you working on right now, and where can my listeners find you?
So I am working on an album by album podcast of Dead or Alive, the 80s synth pop group that'll be out in a couple weeks, which is out now actually if you're listening to this. And there'll also be a Porcupine Tree album by album coming out and some other fun stuff. I believe me and my buddy Brad Page are gonna sit down and talk about Todd Rundgren sometime this year, so that'll be fun.
How is it that we can never avoid talking about Brad Page?
I know, right? Like he's ever present.
Him of the velvety smooth podcasting voice.
Yeah.
And of course, you're referring to your Sly Dog music cast.
Yes, the Sly Dog music cast. Yeah,
Yep.
I should have said that.
Yep, that's right. I'll put a link in the show notes for it.
Yep. Go check it out. Lots of good stuff over there. If you like Van Halen, there's hard rock, there's pop, there's metal. There's all kinds of talk over there. Like you'll find something you love.
Absolutely. And with that, we end this episode of Mr. K's Super Show and our look at Van Halen 45 years on. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to Mr. K's Super Show. If you like what you heard, please write a review on Apple Podcasts and share it on Facebook, Twitter, or whatever social media you like. Thank you for listening to Mr. K's Super Show.
Thank you.